Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. Our new issue is coming out any moment now, I believe. It's going to include an interview with Peter Heller, author of The Dog Stars and most recently The Painter. He was here in Seattle where his book The Painter was selected as a Seattle Reads book, so he's reading it all over town and stopped in and had a conversation with us, and it was fabulous. So you can check that out at authormagazine.org. And, of course, we're funded by the Great Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. Our 60th anniversary is coming up this July 16th at the SeaTac Hilton. So if you want to learn about that conference, and it's a good one, doesn't matter if you want to be if you're a writer looking to connect with agents and editors, or if you're an independent author looking to better learn how to connect with your readers or other independent authors, it doesn't matter. You can learn to connect with all these people at the PNWA conference. So go learn about it at PNWA.org. Speaking of writers' conferences, I will be at the Chuckanut Writers Conference along with today's guests, I believe. I think I saw her lovely face in the catalog. Yes, the Chuckanut Writers Conference this weekend. If you're going to be there in Bellingham, Washington, up at Watcom College, I'll be there talking about all kinds of things. And, well, that's enough about me. Let's talk about today's guest, Stephanie Cowles. You know, I love Stephanie for a lot of reasons, many reasons. But I'll tell you, the last time I talked to her, I think it was after she released, I don't know when it was, actually. I first met her after she had published Sing Them Home, which was her second novel. Her first book, Broken for You, was chosen by Sue Monk Kidd as a Today Show Book Club selection. Wow, what a start. And Sing Them Home was wonderful, and we had a great conversation. And then I had her on Author to Author, and we were talking about, I can't remember what we were talking about. We were talking about how to teach writing and what is important in writing. And I mentioned that I'm not that interested in the craft element. And she said something to the effect of, oh, thank God. That is so not the point. And I thought, I knew I loved this woman. And so let's get Stephanie on to talk about her latest book, Language Arts, as well as all the things that aren't craft that matter in writing. Stephanie, how are you doing?
Bill, so good to talk to you. I didn't know we were going to be teaching together this weekend. That's delightful.
Yes, we are. We probably won't be I don't think we're on a panel together, but no. I'm doing the plenary lecture there, and then a couple, a class and a thing, and so yeah, I'm going
to
be there.
I will come to your lecture. That'll be great.
Oh, it'll be fun. It'll be fun, but and it won't be talking about craft, probably. Really, I don't know if you remember that, Stephanie, but
I don't. But it sounds like a conversation we would have had. Yeah, I always feel ill-equipped to talk about craft. So yeah.
But you have so – this is funny because if someone were to read your work, and I hope our listeners have, you are a beautiful writer, by which I mean this. Stevie. You like Stevie, don't you?
You go by Stevie? Good. Sure.
By which I mean – this is what I mean by you're a beautiful writer. If when I read your stuff, I know that you can – if you have something you want to say, I know that you can say it, that you have command from the mind to the page. I always feel in sure hands with you. And
that's
so
nice to hear.
But it's true. It's true. And so I think any reader reading your work that would be self-evident. And so it would seem like you've got craft coming out of your eyeball. But you say you feel ill-equipped to teach it. Why is that? Tell me.
Well, probably because I never sat in any of the classes at which those kinds of things are discussed. My master's degree is in acting, so I really learned how to talk about writing, not from being in school, but from the writers group that I was a part of for 13 years. That's how I learned to discuss other people's work, what was appropriate to say, what wasn't appropriate to say. Anything I know about the craft of writing does, in fact, come from my years in the theater. I spent 20 years as an actress and a teacher of voice, speech, and dialects. So, but I always feel like there's a excuse me, there's a sort of a lingo around the craft of writing that I never quite acquired. So that's why I say I feel sort of ill-equipped. I always say I can facilitate. I can facilitate. I feel uncomfortable with the word teaching. I know how to teach you to do a Cockney accent, but teaching
right.
you about writing, I'm not so sure about.
You know what it is? You know what the thing about – so I do a lot more teaching now, and I never thought I would do it.
Yeah.
But I do it now, and I realize that what I'm really teaching is for people – I'm teaching people to believe in that timeless flow of creative energy that we enter when we really go deep into the dream, to believe it's possible.
I think that's probably the most important thing one can, you know, cultivate in someone who wants to write, is that that connection and, you know, getting out of our own way and all those sorts of things, which I think is why my favorite books on writing are not really craft books.
No.
One of my two favorites are quite old books. One of them is called If You Want to Write.
Oh, Brenda Yulin.
Yeah. Fantastic book. I mean, just... Yeah. You know, like sitting across the table from a good friend. And another one, which I think is about the same time period, is by Dorothea Brand. It's called On Becoming a Writer. And she's the one, she advocates for morning pages long before we ever heard them called that, by Julia Cameron in The Artist's Way, which is another lovely book. But Dorothea Brand talks about, you know, even the most facile writer can become paralyzed or petrified. And so when that happens, you go back to a very basic practice, which is waking up in the morning, and before you utter a word, you reach for your journal and you start to write. And, you know, that those books are about nurturing a quality that will help you write, you know, and then you can address those craft issues. But I think at the very heart, most... And I remember this very, very clearly before I was published and when I was still finding my way. Most of us just need, as you say, the faith, the courage, the confidence to feel like we have something to say. So that's very important. I'm glad you're teaching that.
Oh, that's what I love to teach, because I feel like even if my students don't write a book, they can take that elsewhere.
Absolutely.
Because, confidence is confidence is confidence.
And, you know, another more recent book that I love, and I've been really trying to attend to this phrase, Linda Berry has a wonderful book on just all things creative, and she talks about the importance of being willing to follow a wandering mind.
Yeah.
I love that. I mean, I just love that. That's why a daily practice of journal keeping can be useful, because you're not planning anything. You're not writing that journal for anybody else's eyes. And I think that is the practice. It's not particularly about being eloquent. It's just about getting out of your own way, letting a thought come into your head and putting it right down on the page. And that is important to practice. That's very important to practice.
Yeah, it is practice. That's the operative word. When I work with my clients, a lot of them really want to write a book and have all this fear. And all of them have had the experience of forgetting to be afraid and letting the thing flow that wants to flow.
Uh-huh.
But then, of course, they remember to be afraid again, and they
right.
are. and I stress, like, this is a practice. You have to go to the desk and practice finding that flow. It isn't going to just – if you practice it enough, you'll find it regularly. But it is a practice. You have to, just like learning to walk on a balance beam, you've got to practice finding that flow, that energy.
Exactly. And another thing Linda Berry says is you have to be willing to be lost, and you have to be willing to fall off the balance beam and know that, you know, the world won't end. And I do think that's very important to have that kind of daily discipline or experience. And then it will make you less afraid when you're trying to write the big scene, or when you're, you know, you're working on an actual piece of text for a book, for a product. Yeah, I agree completely.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of lost, I don't want to presume that you were, but I think the first time I interviewed you was for Sing Them Home.
Mm-hmm.
And in my mind, there had been a book between Sing Them Home and Language Arts, but I don't think there was. I think I was wrong about that.
Well,
I
probably talked about the book that I thought was going to be my third book.
Oh, that's what it was.
Yeah, it was. I spent a couple of years researching this these characters, historical characters that I've been wanting to write about for many years. I wrote a play about them, and I needed a contract, so I really, you know, spent a couple of years researching them and trying to figure out what could I bring to the table new in terms of, you know, a fictional rendering of these characters, and just researching them and their lives and crafting a proposal and writing 100 pages to submit to my publisher, and he hated it.
Oh, no.
He absolutely hated it. And so Language Arts became my third book, and that was because my publisher very generously said, listen, I really want to publish Stevie's next book, just not this book. And if she has a one-page idea for something and I like it, I will put her under contract. So my very wise team of editor and agent said, well, what have you got in the file cabinet? And I knew immediately where I would go. And that's where I went, and thus Language Arts became my third book.
Oh, interesting. But so this is an interesting process, because you obviously had a lot invested in those historical characters.
Yeah.
And Language Arts is not historical. It's based, it's a very contemporary book, very contemporary subject too, autism and family and all the challenges of it. Were you able? Did you find you were able to transfer your interest and curiosity as authentically to it as you had to those historical characters? Was it difficult shifting like that?
The experience of having that kind of unforeseen and very unexpected rejection was difficult, and kind of, you know, made me heart sore for a while. But
yeah.
I did know where I would go, and the genesis, the sole genesis for Language Arts comes from a child that I met over 50 years ago who I have been thinking about since then and trying to write about since 1986. And I had some very early attempts at, you know, creating a short story narrative around him that I brought to my writers group. And they said, basically it's a character sketch. And it's like, yeah, it is. But I figured if that fascination had been with me for over 50 years, then probably I could figure out how to create a novel around this little boy. So that's what I did. And
50 years?
Yeah. I met him when I was 7. And, you know, we get this question a lot as writers: are any of the characters in your book based on real people? And up to this point, I've been able to say no. I don't know if you feel this way, but I feel like our characters are a little bit like Frankenstein's monster. You know, we assemble them from bits and pieces, and then eventually they kind of take on their own soul and their own identity. But, you know, face here, a voice here, a story here.
Yeah.
But this character really was based on a child that I knew when I was 7, and he dropped into my life and then left my life. He was what we called in those days retarded. He was very, very distinctive in terms of his looks. And the only way that real person is in the book is through the description. I describe him in great detail in a chapter called The Boy in the White Suit. Beyond that, though, everything else is invented. I had no relationship with that little boy. His name was Dana, and he is Dana in Language Arts. But my Dana didn't speak. We did not become best friends, unlike the character in my novel, who becomes very close friends with this little boy. And their relationship plays out in a very tragic way that is, you know, totally invented, not part of my life experience. But I feel very, very happy to finally have this child loosed in the world, and I'm very anxious to see what readers make of him. Yeah.
That's so interesting. So something ignited in you seeing him when you were a 7-year-old girl. He made that distinct an impression on you. And, of course, because he was so outside of what you normally experienced. And
right, not
in
only
you
in his behaviors, but in his look. He wore white suits to school every day.
Was he the same age as you? He was your age?
It's hard to say. I believe so. He had very specific mannerisms that I remember very clearly. One of them was he would massage that little web of skin between the thumb and the forefinger.
Yeah.
And very recently I learned from a wonderful woman named Barbara Burnett, who's the mother of a child with autism. She said, that's very typical of a child that has fragile X syndrome. that gesture. Like, really?
Okay.
I said, yeah, I see that a lot.
So,
you know, it's very interesting. I have a very dear friend from my theater life who's been a lifelong educator. She said something really wonderful to me the other day. We weren't even talking about the book. We were talking about kids and education. She said that between the ages of 7 and 10 is when our brains are the most alive to really absorb creative experiences. And
huh.
I really, that was kind of affirmation of you know, the landscape of this book, because it takes place, the backstory of this book takes place when Charles, the main character, is 8 and 9. And that was my experience of having Dana drop into my life when I was 7. It's when I wrote my first short story, which I still have, when I was 7. I really felt, I felt that was true in my own life. And I feel very strongly that that child imprinted on me in a very unique way. And when I talk about the book now, I invite people in the audience or readers to think about their own that time in their own lives between 7 and 10. And was there someone kind of outside the box that you noticed at that point and that imprinted on you in a very unique way, whether it's, you know, that funny relative or someone you didn't know or someone you saw? I do think it's a very special time in our childhood when our awareness starts to broaden beyond our little family unit.
And, oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, it reminds me, my son was pretty far outside the box, and I would go to the school where he, I was like a docent and I would help out. And there was this one boy who was very traditional. I mean, he could hit all the notes a boy at that age was supposed to be able to hit. He was absolutely fascinated by Sawyer, because of what Sawyer wouldn't do and all the things he wouldn't do. And he'd say, what did he do at home? And what does it happen? And why is he doing this? And what he absolutely wanted to understand. And he was just, and every time I'd see him, you know, even after Sawyer left the school, what's he doing now? What's happening? And I think
that's
lovely. Well, something woke up. And well, because, you know, it's interesting, Stephanie, because you talk about the impression the boy made on you. And one of the things I teach when I talk to people whose kids are on the spectrum is, The challenge the parent has to address, which almost never is what that child says about them and what it says about life and how it affects them, not in terms of just caring for them, but just the questions it raises about what it is to be human. And that usually goes unanswered. And that's usually, in my experience, and it was in my case, in my wife's case, where the real stress was. That's where the stress was, not in, because the kid just doesn't know anything's wrong. The kid's just the kid.
Right.
Nothing actually is wrong. Well, don't get me started. Before I hijack this interview. But it struck me as you talked about that, because it's really, what does it say about your life seeing him? What does it mean to you in your own creative experience that this person exists and chose, or not chose, but is behaving in this way?
Well, you know, we're going to have a lot to talk about this weekend at Chuck and I. But, you know, in order to provide a narrative for this little boy, because really he's not the narrative heart of the book. He's, to me, is very much the emotional heart. But the modern or the current story that is happening to this protagonist, Charles, is that he is the divorced father of two, and his older son, Cody, is about to become a legal adult. But Cody has a very severe, low-functioning form of autism. He doesn't speak. He doesn't toilet. He's not able to participate, accomplish the, you know, tasks of everyday living without help. So even though he's about to age out of state-sponsored care and a lot of the things that are available to him as a legal child, he's never going to be an adult in the way that we think of as an adult. So the narrative that I tried to create was one that in which there would be echoes of his relationship with this little boy he knew, you know, 50 years ago, that would kind of have reverberated through his life and affect, of course, his relationship with his son. One of the most interesting things I discovered when I was researching this book and watching documentaries about parents trying to, you know, parent children with autism. And this is going to be in broad, I'm going to say this in really broad strokes, but I learned this from a documentary, wonderful documentary called Loving Lampposts. The documentary maker had a young son who had just been, you know, diagnosed as on the spectrum, and he decided to make a film so he would learn more about it. But there were some really amazing interviews, and what I learned from that documentary is generally there seems to be two camps, or two, when you're talking about what, you know, what it says about you, there seem to be sort of two main approaches among parents, and they're very divisive. On the one hand, there's the it's an illness. There's something caused it, therefore we can cure it. We just have to find out what it is. And, of course, that pushes every button we have as parents.
Yeah.
And in my story, I sort of set that that system of beliefs with Charles' ex-wife. You know, when they get this diagnosis, they don't have any language for it. But their the instinct, Allison, his wife, her instincts lead her right away to, we're going to fix the mold problem in the house. We're going to, you know, we're going to remodel the house.
Right.
Because it's got to be that. We've tried everything else. And then the other general idea is, well, what if it isn't that? What if it's just another way of being in the world? What if it's neurodiversity?
Right.
And what if it's our job to go and meet these children where they are, as opposed to try to make them conform to what we think is normal? Which, again, I understand that too, but in the context of a relationship and a marriage, you really can't. It's very hard to be that second idea, that, you know, that second idea of neurodiversity, and not look like a slacker, or like you're surrendering, or you're giving up, or you're not trying. So that's where I set the two people in this marriage, and there's not a lot of common ground there.
No, there isn't, and that split, by the way, I think that is a fundamental split, not between people. This is why I think what we call autism, what has come to be called autism, is so evolutionary. Is that points to a focus within the question of what a person is and isn't, and that is a split not just about autism. It goes way beyond that. Now I can give you one guess as to where I land, and fortunately, it was where my wife
landed.
I have
a feeling.
Also.
I know.
Yeah, I bet you do. But you know, it's a significant split, and it goes to the question of what is life, and what is it to be alive, and what is happiness,
what does it mean to be
and
human?
The whole what does it mean to be human? And actually, I'll tell you, Stephanie, that occurred to me once. I was sitting at one of these IEP meetings, I was sitting in the Washington Autism Center, and they just gave them the diagnosis, and we were talking about medication and no medication and all this, and I suddenly realized we weren't talking about him. We weren't talking about him or autism or medication. We were talking about what it is to be human. And that wasn't what we were saying, but that's all the question was. And I realized I didn't agree with their idea of what it meant to be human. And I thought, then that's the end of the conversation. But it didn't occur to me until that moment. Well, good for you. You really went right after it.
If I have a hope for this book, other than people looking for their own Danas, it would be... Because I tried hard. I don't know. You'll have to tell me, and other readers will tell me. I tried very hard to be judicious and fair and balanced in writing writing this marriage. Because I absolutely get both viewpoints.
Sure.
I absolutely understand both viewpoints. My hope for this book would be that people in both those camps might start to have some conversations around this. And maybe there isn't common ground, but maybe there's a way to talk together and share and approach each other without, you know, putting up walls. I would be very happy if the book could do that for a couple of people.
But haven't you had that split in your own head? Don't you waffle back and forth about what to be fixed? I'll try and fix it. I'm not going to fix it. I'm going to fix it. There's nothing to fix. There's something to fix. There's nothing to fix. Don't you go through that yourself all the time? Or maybe not all
That's
the time,
really
but haven't you found yourself in argument with yourself about what is to be? Maybe you look in the mirror and say, I've got to fix this. This is a problem. And then there's no problem. And there is a problem. Have you not experienced that in your own just life?
That's such an excellent question, Bill. I mean, I certainly, you know, entertain a couple of characters in my head when it comes to my writing process. As you know, but over the years I've tried to see them more as friends as opposed to adversaries. You know, my left brain is Leonard, my right brain is Rose, and I try to really
you've named them.
Yes. And you know, Leonard always, you know, he occasionally sends emails to Rose. I've tried over the years to because I remember very clearly there was a time when I thought, oh, left brain, enemy, My left brain just wants to edit everything and change everything and fix everything. But, you know, in fact, they are very, they need each other. You know, it's Leonard who makes my writing time possible. It's Leonard who finds articles in the newspaper on the internet that he sends to Rose, you know, because they might enhance her process. So that's such an interesting question, though. I think maybe not as much as I used to. Not as much. Good. Ever since Leonard and Rose have become more friendly. I've had fewer of those kinds of conversations, and I avoid mirrors as much as possible. So,
well, that's awesome. I love that. I've talked to my students sometimes about that the creative process is such a marriage of what we typically think of as masculine and feminine, of the receptive and the orderly, you know, the rational and the intuitive. And you really need both. Otherwise, you just
really
sit there.
You really do. Not just in terms of the writing process, but I think in terms of organizing your time. You need that left brain to say, listen, you're going to, you know, apply the seat of your pants to the seat of the chair now, and I'm going to make sure that nobody else bothers you. You know, I think it is very important to be conscious about those two roles. And certainly, of course, when you're rewriting a book, then you call upon that editor brain a little bit more to, you know, fix things. No, it's a very important balance to have, I think.
I remember when I interviewed Richard Bach, he said he had a part of his mind who would say, Richard, you need to be smart. You need to write something really smart. And he would say, okay, listen, I'm just going to write this thing. Could you leave? And I'm going to write this silly thing, you know, about a seagull who talks, and then you can come back. And so he would send that thing out so he could write the silly thing he wanted to write.
Sometimes you
isn't that a thing, though, Stephanie, writers wanting to seem smart? Is that not... Does that not hang over so many writers' little head?
I think so. And, you know, whoever it was that said murder your darlings, you know, that's definitely, that's on point there. I mean, you know, you have to really be vigilant about, well, yeah, that sounds really great, but is that because I'm going to sound really great, you know? And I tried to play with that a little bit in this book because... the main character is a language arts teacher, and he loves language. And early on in the book, he tries to kind of, he's in the crawl space, and he's come upon an old Life magazine, and it has, you know, that smell that Life magazines have. And he says, you know, I give this kind of exercise to my writing students all the time. I should attempt it myself. So he tries to describe the smell of this Life magazine, and what he comes out with, he says, wow, that's really verbose. That's really pompous. That's really awful. I give myself a solid C. So, but yeah, we do, you know, we don't want to be seen as dummies, you know, so,
but
it's
know
also,
I love what,
go ahead.
You know, I love what, I was going to say what Einstein, and I've come to firmly believe this, that the things that I sound the smartest about, I frequently teach classes where I taught one class, it was mostly PhDs, and I dropped out of school when I was 20, so I didn't even have a college. But I'm the one teaching it, and that
you've done
you know
okay.
why I've done okay. But you know why? Because I follow my curiosity, and I think genius is curiosity.
Well, that's the Einstein quote: "Never lose a holy curiosity." Yeah.
That's what
I
he
actually
said
have some. I have some Einstein. My an Einstein quote was my first tattoo. I have tattoos
what?
Since I've seen, so yeah. Yeah, and I have another one that I'm going to get. This is my favorite one, but when people ask me about process and how do you do it and, you know, do you write this way or this way? And, you know, my agent finally said, you know, you need to stop answering that question. And he was right, because if you try to pin down something, then you're kind of, you know, you're bound to it. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But anyway, I love this quote by Einstein. How do I work? I grope. You know, if he can say that, I can say that.
If it feels true, say it.
They feel like that to me. Every book feels like that to me. It's kind of a groping.
I know. Yeah, that's what Alice Hoffman said, and I interviewed her about it. She said, you know, I start every book and I think, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to write a book.
Well, that's reassuring.
And she's written like 30 of them, you know.
I know. Well, that's very wonderful to hear from somebody. Yeah.
It's true. And of course, and every time she gets to the middle of one, she said to me, I feel like, well, this is just not going to work. this isn't going to happen. And yet,
it's so important to hear that when you're a young writer or a new writer.
Oh,
yes.
Absolutely. It's the writers like yourself and the experienced writers have the same doubts that the new writers have. It's just, I believe you've learned how better to address them and set them aside and work despite them.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's all about just don't stop, don't stop, don't ever stop, don't give up. Yeah. I mean, I do know of writers who Maria Semple is an example. She will write a book, and if it's not working, she will toss it away. I know she's done that at least twice, and I admire her tremendously for it. I think, you know, that's tough to decide. That's a tough decision to reach. But for me, a lot of it's just about having faith and keeping going and, you know, having a good cheering squad, not, you know, people that, you know, and this is when I talk to people about being in a writer's group and how important it is to have the community. And your writer's group can be one person. But basically, sure, what a writer's group needs to do for you is say really one of two things. One of them is, it's great, keep going. And the other one is, it's not good enough, keep going. You know, that's really...
Oh, I like that.
You need people with, you know, for whom you have respect and, you know, you trust their judgment and they're kind and smart and compassionate and all that. But I think that's basically what it boils down to. And I would never have finished Broken for You if I hadn't had a kind group of people saying, keep going, keep going.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, that is the perfect note to end our conversation. You and I will continue it, I hope.
Yes, we will.
And if people are there, they can maybe join in. But until then, the book is Language Arts. I've been seeing all your fabulous posts scattered all over Facebook, and so It looks like you're still on the tour part of this. Is that correct?
A little bit, yeah. Going down to Portland and doing a little do-it-myself tour up through Southern Oregon in August. But, Yeah, it's fun to get out there with this one.
Excellent. Well, best of luck with it, Stevie.
Thank you,
again, it's Language Arts. And if you want to learn more about Stephanie, you go to stephaniecallis.com. Is that what it is? That looks like
it. That's it. That's
all
it.
Right. All right. Thanks again, Stephanie. I'll see you this weekend.
Okay. Thanks so much, Bill.
Yes. Keep going. Keep going. It's true. There is no failure. There's only learning. It's true. It's true. There's no failure. There's only learning. I learned that. Failure is just a word we give for the growth that is learning. Okay. Everybody, next week I'm going to have Richard Bartlett on. We're going to be talking about all things quantum, I think. Until then, again, if you're going to be at the Chuckanut Writers Conference, say hello to me. If not, well, go do something you love, because only good comes of that.